Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. Thanks for all of the great outpouring of love from my dad and from my family. It's really been extraordinary. I know that I always knew that he was loved and admired, but it's great to hear from everybody, people I haven't heard from in a long time. That's the wonderful thing about social media. It's you have the ability to contact people that makes it easier, makes it much more accessible. A lot of people are asking different things, so let me deal with the practical matters first. I think most of you have already seen this post, but in case you haven't, obviously with the COVID thing going on right now, we can't do a service right off the bat like people normally do. So the current plan is, I've talked to Pastor Lacey down in at North Highland Church, who is a prince of a guy, by the way. You people from North Highland, you've got a great pastor, and he's been really good to my parents, and he's just a good man. And the plan is right now, Dad's birthday is August 29th, and it's also Mom and Dad's anniversary. It would have been his 87th birthday, and it would have been Mom and Dad's 65th wedding anniversary. So it's a beautiful day. I mean, an important date, and it's on a Saturday, so that worked out good, worked out well. The plan is that we're going to do a memorial service at North Highland Church on Saturday, August 29th at 2 p.m. Now, that is assuming that the world's going to be in better shape by then. That's nearly 4 months from now, so, you know, we're believing things will be better by then. If, God forbid, they're not, as we get closer to that date, we may have to consider pushing it back some. But I would really like for it to work out to be that day. And he's been great and super cooperative with us about that. So I really appreciate it. My people from South Georgia have asked if we're coming down there, because my parents do have, they have graves that my dad's only seen one time. I don't even know how many years ago this was. He would have been in his 70s then, I guess. And I was talking to Mom and Dad one night. Hey, John, John Suswell, that was a beautiful tribute that you wrote. And if you get a chance, go on my page. Should be right below this, John. Who used to be my parents' neighbor, posted something really nice, and he posted links from the songs that Candy Staton recorded that he produced years ago that I wrote. It's the Anointing and We Adore You, Holy Spirit. So thank you for that. Anyway, years ago, we were talking about it, and I said, you guys, I don't even know what you want. I mean, where do you want to be buried? We've never talked about it. What do you want? I don't have any idea. And if something were to happen to you, I mean, I'm kind of in the dark about it. And my dad was born in a little community right outside of Valdosta, Georgia. It's called Swilly Hill. And he, right across the street from where the church is there, used to be a little very primitive farmhouse where he was born. It's not there now. But, and there's a Swilly Hill Cemetery there. You can go there, and there's like Swillies from the 1800s buried there. But also, my mom's side of the family has a family cemetery right outside of Baxley, Georgia. And, my dad, and I don't think this would be any surprise to the Swillies, he has embraced, for most of his life, he's been, really connected to my mom's side of the family. And some people may not understand why. He loves his Swilly siblings, but they all have plots up in Gwinnett County that they bought together years ago. It's where my where his parents are buried, and my my Aunt Joyce and my Uncle Bobby. But the home place where my great grandparents on my mom's side used to live, I mean, it's still a little dirt road outside. We were there a few months ago for my Uncle Wallace's funeral, and the road is lined with pecan trees that my granddaddy Polk planted back in the 50s, and they're ginormous now. Anyway, years ago, I said to my dad, I said, I don't even know what do I do? I mean, you know, I need to, we need to get this in order. And so they just decided, they, you know, that's all. Dad always wanted to take care of business. He never wanted to be a burden on anybody, never wanted to be a problem. And even just the sense that it might inconvenience me, he must have made a call the next day. And they had, within a few days, they had graves. I'm talking about with the slab and the tombstone and their names and their birth dates on them. I mean, he took care of business. Never even saw them. The only time he even saw the graves was, gosh, it's been, what, 8 months ago now that my Uncle Wallace passed. And Ken and I drove my parents down there for his burial. And I walked Dad up. I said, Dad, here's your graves. He'd never even seen it. And he said, thank you for whoever did this. And I thought, you don't even remember you did this. So I just assumed that's where they would be buried, where it's where my grandparents are buried and great-grandparents and all kind of people in the Polk and Tomberlin side. The reason Dad is so close to Mom's side of the family, my Uncle Harry Meshagan, Bishop Meshagan, who passed a few years ago, he was married to my mom's oldest sister, my Aunt Myrtle, who has also gone on. And Dad worked for him, I think he was his associate pastor when he was in college at Lee, what is now Lee University. So he already had a connection with the family. And even furthermore, the way, I don't know if it's this way now, but the way the Church of God was back then, everybody kind of knew everybody. All families knew each other. And you kind of always married in the Church of God, and people, you know, people did revivals for one another. So the Polks and the Swillies knew each other forever. And, I mean, so long ago that, I mean, so early on that Dad said the first time he ever saw Mom, cause she, you know, she is, has a twin brother, Michael Don Polk. And they were little. I guess my grandmother must have had them on some kind of harness with a leash when they were little, so they didn't run off. So that's how early on he saw my mom. And anyway, so he was super close to Uncle Harry, and Uncle Harry was really as much of a father figure to him as his own father was. And not taking anything away from Pop Swilly, but Dad adored Uncle Harry, and he was really a mentor to him, and probably his best friend for the rest of his life. So he was already close to the Polks. And then my mom's sister, Ernestine, married my Uncle Wallace. So the Polks and the Swillies were intermarried. And then, you know, years later, Dad married Mom. And, you know, back in the 60s, they all lived on the same street together and everything. And I don't think there's any big surprise to his Swilly siblings. He just spent the most of his adult life really more with the Polks. And so that's why he decided to be buried by their graves down there. Well, then a few years later, he decides, to my great surprise, that he wants to be cremated. He had thought about it and decided that's what I want to do. And he and Mom had talked about it, and I could tell they had already come to a decision. And I said, that's fine, but what am I supposed to do with these graves down there? So he said, well, you can inter our ashes there. I said, okay, well, why don't I do this? And this is the plan for those of you from South Georgia who have asked if we're coming down there soon. No, it will be a while. I said, let me do this. When if you go first, I'll save your ashes, and we'll keep them until Mom goes, if that's 10 or 20 years later or whatever. And then with both of you together, I'll take my kids down there and we'll have a ceremony. And he loved that idea. He also wanted, they made a mistake, whoever did the grave, and they've got, right next to my grandmother Addie Mae's plot, they have Dad. And it was supposed to have been the other way around. It's like it's granddaddy, grandmother, dad, and then mom. And he didn't like that. He said, your mother's supposed to be next to her mother. So whenever we do that, we'll have to switch those. And I said, I promise that I'll get that taken care of. In the meantime, and I think Pastor Lacey will be okay with me saying this. He certainly was okay with the request, because I asked him the other day, I said, if this is a problem in any way, because I know some Christians have ethical issues with cremation, and you know, that's a very private thing. Let me take a time out and exhort you. Whatever people want to do about burial, funeral, how they deal with stuff, that's totally their business. You can have an opinion about it, but don't express that opinion. Like someone in a roundabout way expressed to me, are you sure you want to post those sad pictures of your dad at the end? I don't see them as sad, and it's frankly our business. So you do what's right for your family, and we won't express an opinion about it, and we'll do what's right for our family. And that goes for everybody. However you want to do it, however you want to do a funeral, whatever you want to do, my feeling is if whatever your wishes are, they should be honored. So I did ask him, I said, I don't want to necessarily include this in the memorial service, but would it be okay with my children to privately scatter some of Dad's ashes there at the prayer tower? They have a, it's like a big monument. It kind of nearly looks like a tombstone. And he thought that was a beautiful idea. And I said, be truthful with me. If that's a problem, since you're the pastor there, I don't want to overstep anything. And he said, no, that's beautiful. We'll by all means do that. I hope he's okay with me letting you know that, but because people have asked, what are y'all going to do? Are you burying or whatever? And it's a reasonable question. I also, had posted the other day, when we do a memorial service, in lieu of flowers, people have asked you, they send flowers. We, would prefer that you make, contribution in Dad's honor to the, Alzheimer's, forgot which one it is. There's several of them. It's a link on my page. Alzheimer's Society, I think it is. I'm sorry, I haven't slept much. I can't remember which, but you get the point. So we would prefer, flowers are beautiful, but anybody that's doing research that helps people not go through what we've just been through with my dad, we'd rather think the money would go there. So by the way, I see all of your comments come in, but I'm not going to look at them because I don't want my ADD to kick in and I start. But I appreciate you. I love the comments. I'll read them all later, so feel free. So that's the plan. Let's see, was there anything else I was going to ask? Mom and I, we went through Patterson's, which is such a great organization here in town. And Dad will actually be cremated on Friday. And that was his desire. So, and I've already set up the, I already knew in advance what I wanted for a ceremony. I just got off the phone with Chandra Corelli a few minutes ago. She did a song at both her mother and mother-in-law's funerals that just blew me away. It's an old song called There's a Leak in the Building. And it's a metaphor for when the house is condemned, it's time to move on. And it's very powerful. And I said, Chandra, I want you to sing that. And I said, I want you to kill everybody with it. I mean, I don't want you to hold back, which she knew what I meant. And I've also asked, Marshall Ruffin, he does a version of I'll Meet You in the Morning, which my dad always liked that song. So he's going to do that. And that in both cases, they know if we have to move the date, they're flexible. And I've asked, when we do it, I've asked Pastor Lacey to participate, and also Greg Kinnard. He can play, but I want him to speak. And all four of my kids, and I may do some spontaneous things with some people that I know are going to be in the audience. Thank you for the tribute from Pastor Jensen Franklin. Jensen is my cousin on my dad's side. Well, my cousin-in-law, if that is such a thing. He's married to my first cousin, Charisse. He wrote a really nice tribute. It's on my page. I didn't realize that he perceived that Dad had helped him that much, but that was really, really sweet of him. And You know, please, anything I'm about to say, don't get offended. I'm recently orphaned, so go easy on me. But in my family, we're all over the map politically and theologically, because there's Jensen, who's an advisor for Donald Trump. And then I've got my Uncle Don on the other side, and all you have to do is look at his page. He's on the other side of the universe of that. And I think, wow, that's the North and South Pole. And our family falls in the political line on somewhere between those two polarities. But here's my feeling about when someone has passed away, it's time at that point, everybody puts aside their agendas, their politics, their theology or whatever. Pastor Lacey, it would be very easy for him to be uncomfortable with me being in his pulpit because, you know, I'm an out gay man, and he's just very respectful and without compromising his stance on anything. The fact is, my dad loved me and supported me, even on the things he didn't fully understand. He was just my dad. He was never making some statement for gay rights. He's just being my dad. So, and I appreciate, because everybody's been really cool. Even the last two or three days, people that I sort of ended badly with, because, you know, I lost a lot when I came out 10 years ago. But even people that hadn't spoken to me in all that time have even written. And so that's great. You know, one thing about, whether you call it death, I mean, death may be just a perception, I don't know, but it is kind of a great equalizer, you know. Just, I don't know, it puts things in perspective, and you just need to lay aside your stuff and just think about life, because it's going so fast. So that's the practical stuff. Some people have kind of gingerly asked, you know, what happened there at the end. They don't know. And I'm okay with that. With questions like that. That doesn't bother me. I mean, I've been around people crossing over so much. I'm not insensitive to it. I'm just so accustomed to it that, like, for instance, the first night I met Ken, we met online, and I'd dated enough by that point that I had read the profile, and I said, look, there's no point in us meeting. Let's save us both some time, because we're long distance and blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, can we at least meet? And I said, okay, that's fine. So he came to my loft, and he was kind of telling me who he was and told me about him taking care of his mother, who died of Alzheimer's a decade ago. And I asked him everything about it. Like, what was it like? Were you with her when she died? That really was what bonded us. I mean, I heard him when he got through telling the story, I was sobbing, and I thought, wow, this is a really good man. And all these years later, that's borne out. He definitely is. So I have no problem people asking. Even this morning, somebody that I only know through Facebook messaged me and said, I hope this isn't inappropriate, but we just had to put my mother in hospice and my dad's not dealing with it well. Can you tell me anything? And I said, there's nothing I can tell you. I mean, you just have to do it. You just do it, and you get through it, and you will get through it. And you feel whatever you're going to feel, and it is what it is. I mean, I'm not being dismissive about it. It's just, you know, everybody deals with things differently. And I've noticed, you know, that quote, we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. Like, I can tell the way people try to comfort you or whatever, they're speaking from their perspective. Like, some people say, you know, it's okay to scream or cry or be mad or whatever. And I think, I'm not any of those things. I mean, we've certainly cried since Monday, but when you've been a hands-on caretaker, and especially these last several months, I mean, it's taken Ken and Mom and me virtually around the clock to care for Dad. So those of you that have been caretakers will understand what I mean by this. The first thing you feel is relief. I mean, before you even get to grief, you just want to be quiet. I mean, I haven't even turned the TV on because I just don't want the noise. Just like, because we haven't really slept or rested or relaxed in I don't know how long. And the other thing is, those of you speaking of perspective, those of you that have had parents with dementia know that the person that everybody else knew, you lost them a long time ago. That's what's so different about this kind of passing, because the man that everyone else knew as my dad, he hasn't been here for some time. So when they say it's the long goodbye, it is the long goodbye. And it's a long, hard goodbye. So you certainly grieve, and we're dealing with it in our own way, but it's just, it's very different when they go this way. And, you know, no regrets. It is what it is, but, you know, that's the thing. So since people have asked what happened, I don't make any apologies for being candid with people about what's going on. I feel like anything I've posted has been in good taste. I never want to paint my dad in a negative light. But I've been transparent my whole life. And people who are very private don't understand that. And that's fine. That's their prerogative. But I've always lived my life as an open book. Yesterday I posted something. It was really cool. Somebody sent me a message who never went to dad's church, never sat under his ministry, because most of the people who have contacted me, you know him that way. And this was so cool. You can scroll down on my page and see it. This person said, "I never heard your dad preach, but I met them in a Kmart years ago, like 15 years ago. Dad was getting a fishing license, and I observed your parents together, how they interacted with one another and how they spoke to me like they had known me my whole life." Because the person, I don't know if it's he or she, must have recognized them from ads that they were running in Columbus at the time for their church. And this person said, "I could tell they'd been together for a long time, that they knew each other really well. And they showed me the love of God just out in everyday life." And I thought that, you know, that may be the best, one of the best tributes I've heard to my dad, because that's who he really was. It wasn't just a performance. I mean, that's who he was. So I kind of learned to be transparent with him. As a matter of fact, when I came out in 2010, I talked to him about saying something about it publicly, because I had never planned on saying anything. And I said, "Dad, look, this is what I'm thinking about doing. What do you think? Should I not tell the church what's really going on?" Because people were like, why are you and Debbie divorcing? They couldn't understand it. And, you know, when you've lived your life trying to tell the truth as much as you can, it's really hard to lie. I'm not a good liar. So, I actually thought he was going to say, "You better keep that private and don't put that out there." He's actually the one who said, "Look, if there's a parade going on about you, you need to be the drum major of it. So get in front of it, tell it from your perspective before people have a chance." Hey, Avery, I'll get back to you in a minute. People have a chance to, come up with their own spin on things. And that's why I was so confident in what I said that night. Because he had said, "No, you need to tell your story and make it your story." I thought, wow, okay. And I've always appreciated that about him. The thing about dementia, Alzheimer's, I mean, as much as I've read about it over the years, I mean, he's really kind of had it for about 5 years, really severely in the last couple of years. And it's a strange thing, because the brain comes in and out of lucidity. Like, for a while they'll be themselves, and you'll think, "Oh, I think they're them again." And then you realize they're not. Like, even, I don't remember when this was, we had like a really, really bad night with him. I mean, one of those nights where you think we can't handle this at home. We're going to have to get professional help. And usually when a thing like that would happen, the next morning, he had no recollection of it. And that next day, he had his head down on the kitchen table, and Mom and I were just standing there looking at him. And he sat up and he looked at us and he said, "How long have I been like this?" It's like he kind of somehow had some perspective on it. And I said, "A few years." And it really, I could tell it really hit him. You know, he just stared off into space for a few minutes. And what I'm about to tell you, I have to, you know, I'm all about context. And a few months ago, I had taken him and mom to the doctor. And on the way home, she had to go into the phone store and get her phone seen about. So I was sitting with him in the front seat. And we weren't talking. I mean, you just get used to not talking to somebody at a certain point, because sometimes it makes things even worse the more you talk to them, because they don't understand what you're saying. So we had just kind of gotten used to being silent together. And we were sitting there and he looked at me and he said, "I need you to tell me what to do." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "About what?" He said, "About my life." And I said, "Well, Dad, I can't tell you what to do. I mean, we're trying to figure it out. We're taking it one day at a time." And he said, "I know I'm being a burden on everybody." And I said, "No, you're not. You have an illness and we're dealing with it like you would for us. If it was one of us, you would take care of us. And so you can't feel bad about it. It just is what it is. And we're okay. I mean, we love you and whatever." And for any of you that knew my dad, my dad was, you know, he was such a macho guy. You know, he came from that generation where you never admit you're wrong, never apologize, you know, love Clint Eastwood movies, had a gun collection, you know, just for him to say to me, "I need you to tell me what to do." I mean, that was something I didn't even have. I didn't even have neuropaths in my brain for that, because our whole relationship had always been, "Nobody tells me what to do." I mean, you know, you've probably got a dad that's like that too. And I felt a lot of compassion for him that day, but I remembered it because I felt like it was him speaking to me in a moment of clarity, man to man, saying, "I don't know how to handle this. You're going to have to take over." So, you know, we progressed and finally, I've lost track of time. It seems like, 2 months ago, Ken and I finally, you know, we just couldn't keep driving over here in a panic to deal with the situation. I said, we're going to have to just be there, move in, because mom can't handle this by herself, which was, you know, the right thing to do. And I mean, some of that time he's been in the hospital. You know, we're trying to get his meds straightened out, but it's been unspeakably hard. It just has been. And it's so interesting about how people, you know, my dad had developed enough verbal skills over the years that if you just interacted with him a little bit, he could kind of banter with you enough that if you didn't know who he was or that he was sick, you wouldn't know. I mean, after a while, you would know, but he kind of, you know, he had his little verbal bag of tricks that he would say, and he kind of kept those with him. So sometimes people would say, "Well, I talked to your dad the other day. He seemed fine." And I think, he probably did while you were talking to him, because he's just so used to, when somebody makes a demand on him, being on, that he could still do that. Even when the first time we put him in the hospital is because it was situations that were just out of control. They were becoming dangerous to him and to us. And so then the second time we put him in the hospital and they changed his meds, it was the other side of the spectrum. He was just nearly catatonic. But both situations are difficult, but at least that second way was, you know, much more manageable. Not necessarily easier. I mean, I haven't slept in so long because I'm so used to just, you know, sleeping with one ear open. Was that him? Did he fall? Did he try to get up? Whatever. And it's exhausting in a way there's no way to explain if you've never been through it. Like, a good night's sleep doesn't fix it. Like, you wake up in the morning tired. But, Monday of last week, I just could see he was regressing a lot. And I texted the kids because we believe in the quarantine. We believe in the isolation. My kids have taken that very seriously and I applaud them for that. So we haven't been together at all. On the night of my birthday, I drove to Christina's house and the kids sat out in the front yard in blankets away from each other and we spoke for a few minutes, but that's all we've seen. So, last Monday, I texted them, and I said, this, may be premature, but I think, if you're going to see him, you may want to come on, why don't we do it tomorrow night? And I said, we'll observe the protocols. We can come in one at a time and y'all can wear masks, whatever. And so they came. Now, Jared and his fiance live up in, New York. He's, working for her dad right now. And so he couldn't fly down. But the other three came over and, I'm not saying dad was necessarily himself, but when they got here, he kind of rallied enough that it nearly made it look like I was overreacting. You know, like they didn't say this, but I could tell they were thinking he doesn't seem that far gone. And I wanted to say, this is not how he is. This is, he's just this way because you guys are here. And whether he recognized them or thought he should I don't know. But he rallied, and those of you that watched my message Sunday, he actually put together a sentence because Judah was talking to him, and somehow he responded, and he said, life is good. That's really the last lucid sentence that he said, and it's kind of become very important now. It seems to have summed up his life. There was one point where we were kind of just talking to him, whether he was responding or not. And I said, I looked at him, I said, Dad, are you tired of fighting? And he looked at me, he said, nope. I thought, oh, well, okay. We might not be as close to the end as I thought. But they had a great, we just decided, you know what, we're already here. Let's just take the masks off and we're going to risk it. We've been isolated for all these weeks. Cause I didn't want to terrify Dad. He doesn't know what's going on. I want all these people standing around masks on. And so, you know, they took the risk and it was fine. And we went out in the front yard and ordered some chicken afterwards and had a little time together. Well, after they left, he just started really, it kind of brought some closure and he started, kind of going down. And, my cousin Lori on my dad's side asked if she could bring his brother over. Is that Saturday? And, I said, yeah, that's fine. And my Uncle Harry, who's, 13 months younger than him, came over and it was bittersweet. It was sad. I said, Uncle Harry, why don't you pray for him and just give him permission to go? Cause most of the time, if dad hasn't known who I am for a long time, most times he thinks I'm his, I have two Uncle Harrys, Harry Michigan and Harry Swilly. He most times thinks I'm his brother Harry. And I learned, those of you that have had this know, you can't, there's no point in arguing with him. Cause if I say to him, I'm not Harry, I'm your son, it stresses him out because then they realize something's wrong. So I've just agreed to it. And there's sometimes he's thought I was his dad. I mean, it's a trip and it triggers a lot of your unresolved issues. I mean, it just is what it is. So, and then later in the day, I hope I'm not saying these days wrong, but I ask, cause even, Don and Clarice and LaDonna and Tony, they all live not across the street. It's kind of like adjacent, cul-de-sacs. Like we can see their house from, mom and dad's front door, but they haven't been over. We haven't been over there. And I texted them. I said, you might want to come over and spend some time with Dad if you want to see him. Cause they've definitely been invaluable how much, especially my Uncle Don, how much they've helped with Dad over these years. And so they came over and, we sang, Clary sang, played the piano in the next room and we sang and Dad laid there with his eyes open and looked at us. And, but I noticed, he was starting to make a really, some people, this was even more extreme than what they call death rattles. It was like a lot of fluid and the hospice came and they set him up with oxygen, which helped a little. And there was a pill they gave him that helped kind of bring that down some, but it was still just, it was bad. It was a bad noise. But I noticed when people would come over, he didn't do it. I thought, wow, you know, in his own way, he's a gentleman to the end. You know, like he'll make this terrible noise until people are here. And then he somehow instinctively stops it. And then later in the day, my cousin Dwayne asked if he could bring my Aunt Ernestine over, and he and Sonny came over, and that was fine. And then Jared texted. He said, "Did y'all sing?" He said, "I'm so sorry, I missed the singing. Please record it." I said, "Well, we already did it." So I texted LaDonna. I said, "I hate to ask y'all for an encore performance, but Jared's freaking out. Can y'all please come back over and sing again?" So they did, and we all sang again. And Ken recorded it, but we don't sound all that good. I was going to post it, and I was like, "Nah, I'm going to post that." But it was the thought that counts. And I had Jared on FaceTime so he could hear it, and he's sobbing. And then later that night, maybe this was Sunday. I think, you know what? My bad. Uncle Harry came on Saturday. They came on Sunday. That's right. So that night, they stayed for a long time, and then the kids came back over. Debbie asked if she could come over. I said, "Yeah, that's fine. He was your father-in-law for many years." So she came. And the other thing was, Jared texted back and he said, "I want to sing a song to Granddaddy." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Do you want to do it before your siblings get here?" He said, "No, I want them to sing with me." And I thought, oh my God, this is going to kill me. And it did. They sang, "Will the Circle Be..." "Will the Circle Be Unbroken?" And it was hard, but it was beautiful. They sang it, and Jared's sobbing and singing, and we're all sobbing, and it was rough. And then we just kept his phone on the bed with FaceTime so he could just interact with everybody. And Dad was a very good grandfather, and he had, and I guess this is true for everybody, he had special things with them that he never had with me. Like there's this thing he used to quote called Elmer and the Bear or something. He must have quoted it to them enough when they were little that they can quote it too. And I've never heard it. I don't even know what they're talking about. It was like a special thing that they had with him. And, so anyway, the kids stayed for a long, long time until we finally, you know, he was sort of resting, kind of making that noise a little bit, but not too bad. So finally they went on. And Mom, bless her heart, was just exhausted. And she's been an incredible trooper. And, Ken and I have done the heavy lifting, literally and figuratively, but she's always in the middle of it and taking care of everything. And finally, at a certain point, her little body was so exhausted, she just went and laid down. And Ken went to bed, but Ken's was better at administering and managing the meds than Mom and I were, because he's just had more experience with it. So we didn't ask him to do it. It just kind of fell into place that he did that. So he set his alarm for every 2 hours to get up and give Dad morphine. And I just went and sat down by his bed, turned off the lights. I'm just sitting there in the dark. And he's making this sound. I mean, it just sounds like he's drowning. And it was going on and on and on. And we had his hospital bed sitting up. And he had the oxygen going. And around 2 a.m., I posted about it. I said, "I'm just sitting here in the dark. Listen, I'm not sure what I'm waiting for." But we really wanted him to go from here. I know some of you have had to do this, and this is nothing. I mean, you do what you got to do. I didn't want some nurse from the hospital to call and say, "We found him this morning." I mean, we really, even though we've needed the hospital's help, and they have been awesome. We just wanted to bring him home one time, and he really loved this house, was very proud of it. And I thought, man, it would just be best case scenario if he could go from here. So, it had been 4 days since he'd even eaten a bite. And then we finally, sometime during this time, hospice had come in and set up, and they said, just, there's no point in feeding them or giving them meds at this point. Just make them comfortable. So again, we don't know how long that goes. And so, Ken came down for the 3 a.m. morphine, and the sound's just getting louder. In the meantime, during the night, I would walk over and put my hands on his head, and I'd say, Dad, look, everything's fine. We've all told you bye. You don't have to stay and take care of stuff. You've provided this home for Mom. We're here taking care of her. You and I are good. Whatever issues we've ever had, they're long resolved. So you don't have to wait for that. I said, just, you know, be at peace. You know, stop. You don't have to keep fighting like this. And, when Ken came down for the 3 a.m., he just stayed. He laid down on the little sofa and was kind of dozing off. But I asked him, I said, how long do you think he can go like this? Because the sound was just getting louder, and it was a horrible sound. My mom said, I can't bear it. I can't stand to hear him make that noise. And Ken said, well, when my mom was like this, they put her on oxygen. She lasted another week. And I said, he can't go that long. This is too much. It's too much for everybody. We're exhausted. He's exhausted. I mean, he's not even really here. And so finally, I guess around 4 a.m., I guess I must have dozed off in the chair. And I woke up at 4:59 because I thought, oh, it must be time for his 5 o'clock morphine. And then I heard Ken's alarm go off. And when it did, I remembered my dad saying to me, I need you to tell me what to do. And something just came out of me. I just stood up. I said, enough, enough. And I knew it was the right thing. This can sound harsh, but I knew this is what he would want me to do. I walked over. I said, Dad, enough. I took the oxygen out of his nose because the noise was becoming so loud. It was just rattling the windows. And I laid the bed down. I laid him flat. I said, Dad, you don't live in this body anymore. You don't live in this world anymore. You don't live in this house anymore. You have to go now. I didn't ask him to go. He told me to tell him what to do, and I did. I said, you have to go. You can't stay here anymore. And within about 5 minutes, he did it. He did what I told him to do. He just breathed less and less and less, and then he was just quiet. And so by that all happened in a span of 15 minutes, right before he left. I said, Ken, come over here. I think he's going. And so Ken and I stood there and watched him. He didn't struggle. He went peacefully. But it was like a kind of thing where I just manned up and told him as a man what to do. You can't stay in this body anymore. I was talking to Judah about it, and Judah said it's kind of like when a soldier's been mortally wounded on the battlefield and you know they can't survive it, the merciful thing to do is to say it's over and put them out of their misery. And that's what I did. And then we went and woke up Mom. I said, Mom, he's gone. And of course we all cried, and we did all that. And then we've been in this caretaking mode for so long, we just went right into caretaking. You call the hospice, you do the thing, you call the funeral home, boom, boom, boom. And I mean, so much stuff happened so quickly. The funeral home came within, a couple of hours. And it was very dignified. It was beautiful morning. The birds were singing, and they were really good guys. They were all dressed up in the morning. And I was glad it happened early in the morning because the neighbors were probably all still asleep, and just very, in a very honorable way, I just walked him out to the, it didn't look like a hearse. It looked more like an SUV, but they took him. And then we just got busy with getting the house back together. I mean, like 12 hours later, I came in and brought food in, and I said, wow, you would never know what's happened here. And we did that mainly for mom because, you know, if you've been caring for somebody at home, you collect, you've got so many walkers and wheelchairs and porta potties and railings on beds. Like there's reminders everywhere of it. And so we just got everything, you know, back together again. And I knew, not everybody can do it that way. And I wouldn't have done that earlier. I mean, I waited as long as I could, but at a certain point I realized he can't leave this body until I tell him to. I can't ask him to. I've got to speak to him in a way that he'll understand. And when I declared I stood up from that chair and said, enough, everything started changing then. And, cause he wasn't in a space where he could say, into your hands, I commend my spirit. If someone's still in their right mind when they live, then they can do that. They can have a last word or something, but he wasn't capable of doing that. So, every good thing that you've written about him is true. It's not hyperbole. He really was that. I don't think it's any secret that he and I had issues over the years, but big picture, he was always, always there for me. Always a good dad. I wrote some of those things that I posted last night, things that I've written. I wrote those when I posted those pictures. But one thing I wrote about 4 years ago, I was talking about how he'd been a mentor of mine. And when I was his associate pastor, I mean, Lord knows we did things differently, but he never micromanaged me. He always let me make my own mistakes and learn from them. I worked for him for 5 years, and then I went and started my church, and he never made me feel like I was abandoning him. Matter of fact, the first time I ever drove to Conyers to look for a building, he drove me there. We looked for a building together. And, you know, then, and I'm only saying this because it's public knowledge. I mean, I told it on my coming out video, but, and this is nothing against the Assemblies of God. This is just they have certain standards. That's part of that's who they are. But after I came out, you know, he was kind of given an ultimatum. You know, they interpreted him still going to my church as supporting a gay agenda. I thought, my dad's, he doesn't have a gay agenda. He's just my dad. And I told him, even back then, I said, Dad, you've had all these, you know, what, 55, 56 years of scandal-free ministry. Don't, you know, I'm used to controversy, but you're not. So just go to an Assembly of God church. You think a lot of Tim Hogg, go to his AG church in Conyers. That's fine. It's fine with me. And instead, he went in and relinquished his credentials to them, which for him was a huge thing. I would have never asked him to do that. And when he did that, I said, that's such an act of redemption that if you and I ever had like that, that takes care of any things I wish you had done differently. We're good, because that's huge. I would have never thought you would have done that. And that's nothing against the Assemblies of God. I mean, everybody has to stand for what they think is right. And so I'm not even mad at them for that. I mean, I understand it. But when push came to shove, I mean, I was always close to mom. But if I was ever in trouble, she knew if I ever called the house and didn't say hello to her and just said, let me speak to dad, that meant I'm in trouble. And I knew there's nothing, I mean, I could call him for anything. If I had come to him and said, I've got to have $10,000 by tonight, he would have figured out some way to get it. I mean, he was always that guy till the end. And so I don't have any. Here's the thing about caretaking. If you've ever really cared for somebody up until the very end and done the really hard stuff, you kind of have already gone through your, it's like, it's so hard. It's so hard. It's really bad. I mean, there's a few days recently that I just thought, God, we can't, sometimes when Ken hasn't been here, mom and me trying to move him and lift him, it's like, we can't, oh, Jesus, help us. I mean, we're like trying to bathe him and lift him and clean him and just saying, God, help us. And, but when you do that, it's in a way, it kind of, I mean, I can tear up now talking about it, but it's like you don't, lay around and cry all day because it's like you've channeled all of that into that caretaking so that, you know, by the time they finally cross over, you're like, I did everything I could possibly do for this person. I did more things for them than they would have ever wanted me to do for them. And, it, in a way, it helps you deal with the grief process. I don't wish it on anybody. And I can't even say it's a beautiful experience because it's uglier than it is pretty, but it does help you deal with the process. And even, I think it was maybe the night before he left, I came back down to Mom's bedroom. She was still up. And I said, Mom, I need to make sure you understand how close we are to the end. He is here. And she said, yeah, I need you to keep pulling me away from denial. And I said, well, I understand. I mean, that's all you've ever known is being married to him. And she said, I'm just sitting here worrying that maybe we didn't do everything right. What if I gave him the wrong dosage? What if I said, stop. Stop that right now. I said, you and me and Ken and my Uncle Don and my cousin LaDonna and Aunt Clarice, but especially the three of us, we have gone above and beyond. I don't want to ever hear you say that again. I said, I don't feel any regrets at all. I know that we went the extra mile. And so for people that say, how's your mom doing? I mean, she's a trooper. I mean, she's strong. It's hard for her. And you'd have to understand our humor. My mom has a dark humor that I don't think anybody but me ever sees. It's our way of dealing with stuff. And so I've been the last day or two, I've been calling her the widow of Zarephath. You might not understand our humor, but that's my new name for her, to say, Mom, you've been widowed. You're going to give the widow's mite. And she understands how we joke about things to deal with heartache. And she certainly got to learn a new normal. And I did tell her, I said, you can't plan on doing this anytime soon. I'm not ready for you to do this. So don't. And even one of her little dogs, the other night, we were just like right in the middle of something horrible dealing with Dad. And one of her dogs, who has had some issues anyway, started, I don't know, kind of like, we don't know what she was doing, but she's had kidney issues anyway. And I looked at her and said, Mitzi, you can't do this right now. In the name of Jesus, you've got to get it together because I can't deal with you, you know, going right now. The vet had to come pick her up and do a procedure, but she's okay. Anyway, as usual, I've probably talked too long. I'm not going to apologize for it. It's what I do. I talk a lot. If you don't like it, don't listen. But that's where we are right now. That's the plan. Memorial service, August 29th. And thank you to everybody. I'm sure there's somebody I forgot to thank. Just please forgive me. As far as I know, I thanked everybody personally. But I do like to give. That's not the reason why people do it. But I think it's important to acknowledge when people have done something. So I try to remember to thank everybody. And if I haven't thanked you here, just forgive me. The omission is not intentional. I'm not mad at anybody today. I'm just tired and, you know, we're trying to find out what's next. Anyway, that's the deal. So no, we're not, those of you that are in Baxley that have asked, we're not coming down there hopefully anytime soon. We will eventually be there. And we'll inter his ashes there. Nothing against anybody else. I'm not the kind of person that wants to keep ashes in an urn. That's not comforting to me. For some people it is. I would rather put them somewhere that was meaningful to the person. I'm not judging anybody else. That's my prerogative. And Mom feels the same way. So, That's all. Just thank you for the love. Thank you for the outpouring. I'm going to sign out now and start reading your comments. I love you all. Peace.